that picks back being back here in Cork after 5 years away, I believe. And I'd like to thank Paul Casey and Avi for having me here. I'm very happy to be able to read to you from this book, Along the Flag and Shore, Poems in West Clare, because although this is my third book that basically has to do with Ireland, it's the first one published in Ireland, so I'm very happy about that. It's always interesting to me, and maybe just a bit frightening to stand up before a group of people and tell them about their country. A lot of people don't like that. And but I've invested 40-some years in making this as much as possible my country, and have feel that I've become sort of wiggled my way into a family and have sort of a second family here. So it's been a real part of my life for 40-some years. So I'll start out with something called a stolen song, or a cheap shot, okay? From the 14th century Irish. I am of County Clare, that lovely county. When I am grown a man, fair maid of Quilty, to the crosses of Anna, I beg thee, in the name of charity, come dance with me. You will recognize I am a bard of the Holy Ghost. Moonless county road, as though we are crossing a continent of the great American desert, instead of traveling 17 short miles from Ennis to Letterkelly. Once you are inside this postage stamp island and get to know it, you become lost in a much larger world and no longer care how vast the sky or the outside world is. Tonight, as we take the sharp bends, the narrow road embraces us, gathers around our shoulders like an old woman, like around our shoulders like a comforting old wool coat on a rainy night. As we travel up the dark tunnel, Falcha, the old road says, we are welcome at home again. I know you all know about the sad plight of the Irish bachelor, the old fellows. And believe it or not, there's still a few of them around, but they're fewer and fewer. Which is one of the things I notice when I come to Ireland every year or every other year, is that all the old fellows that are gone at the pub. Michael Neal. His parents gone for decades. He too was gone, submerged in years he scarce remembers. Now even drink has forsaken him, but he's floated to the surface from the dark seas of Portland. His legacy is turned to perfect stillness and flags of Liscannor's stone. They need a bit of brushing up to bring, I'm sorry, I just. They'd need a bit of brushing to bring up the shine, he says, like himself returned from the gloom, ink black as the stones he walks. But his face brightens the long dead hearth where we sit talking. I was hard put to recognize the shining face when he came to the door. It's so quiet out here, down at the end of the Boreen, difficult to fathom how he lives. Imagine how he saves the hours or kills them. Oh, I'll try this one. Persephone, Book of Daniel, I don't know if you know these things. Fog Angel. Though more literate than most, He never read the book of Daniel, nor knows about Susanna and the elders, never saw the paintings, the old bachelor farmer who is gone behind the shed. As he starts to unbutton, he freezes, breath caught by what he spies from his vantage through the trees. Sun bathing nude by the hedge, Benton's Persephone, all marble, white flesh, nakedness he never witnessed even in dream. He covers himself before such a vision, but his eyes brighten, devour every inch that body sent down to him from the heavens as he fumbles through the buttons. And all the years never saw in the dark back bedroom such a miracle. There was no marriage bed for him. Sex was animal husbandry. A cow no beauty, nor the bull as it plunged its pike into its mad mate. But there was an exotic daintiness in the carefully wrapped mare's tail bandaged for the violent coming together of her and the raging stallion. Today, when it happened, better had it been the dream come true years back when he found a woman, though fully dressed, asleep on his doorstep. Now he waits, slow his coming, then she is gone, that carnal vision, back into the doorway dark. Here again, I'll read this poem actually written here in Cork 3 years ago. From my vantage in the hotel room down on the river. Here again. On another island between the north and south channels of the Lee, watching cars crossing Ponthar Bridge, I see my nephew's face scarred from fighting battles we'll never know. Outside, suddenly breaking into my thoughts, a sea lion surfaces from the brown river, unlikely this far from the sea in the city of Cork. But he is unlikely, appears when I least expect him. The head pops up, then disappears. I'm hallucinating, I think, as his whole body breaks the surface. He turns to me, warning me to stop before I reveal too much of the story. He was my nephew, or wasn't, my half-brother, warrior, born under the sign of water, drowned in his own blood. He comes to me in strange places, not in dreams, but disguised as some other creature from the real world. I think the cool thing about this poem is that I was sitting trying to write a poem, and I look out the window and here's the sea lion. That's my poem. But a poet from the north and fiction writer, Dermot Healy, who died not that long ago, I guess about 2014, a great Irish writer, but unfortunately succumbing to a disease that hits a lot of Irish poets and a lot of poets everywhere. Sea Sand. For Dermot Healy, 1947 to 2014. He went back to Ballyconnell to face again the edge of the Atlantic in Sligo. That's the way I picture you, standing outside your poet's home in the wind looking towards Inishmurry. I retreat to my cottage in Clare, where above the turf fire the hearth weeps. You'd likely say it's because the foolish mason who used beach sand washed in brine. But I say here, a few miles from Atlantic breakers, on this wet, dark night, the sand misses the shore. The sea is calling back its salt. This poem takes advantage of two different cultures, two very different cultures, but two cultures who have, in a way, suffered in many ways, in many similar ways, and this is called The Tenant of the World. We kiss our fingertips, touch the mezuzah as we leave the house. During the evictions, the man of the house, before it was knocked, planted a kiss on the doorpost. Each passing family member kissed the tips of fingers, traced the outline of the missing mezuzah. When Irish peasants, their families and possessions were set out on the street, and Jewish families were driven from the shtetl, they must have known. And following up on that, this is a poem I call The Mass Grave near Innis Steinman, County Clare. And many of you will have noticed that in recent years, these mass graves and so forth have been not exactly discovered, but pointed out so that people can know where they were. And there are lots of reasons why people, I guess, haven't done that up to now. One, they didn't really particularly want to turn something like that into a tourist attraction, but also there's the element of shame. That part of people that I know, of course, and nobody's around that remembers it, of course, and the people that I know closely simply did not want to have to deal with something as terrible as that. And it's the same way with the Jewish people in the Holocaust. Mass grave near Innis Steinman, County Clare. Their blood became the rain that nourishes the grass. Grass they tried to eat, their teeth stained forever green, their flesh now that piece of ground, where not even a hollow remains to show where the earth sucked in its belly, tightened its straw belt to the last notch. I kind of recently, I'm always discovering things about myself, but I only recently, I think, found out, as I think, that at least from one side of my family, the people came from the north of Ireland, from a place possibly called Ballyboyne. But of course, if you look on the map of Ireland, you're going to find, I don't know how many Ballyboynes, a lot of them. I think there's one in Dublin, actually. This one is supposed to be a little east of Belfast. Ballyboyne. He hadn't a coin to flip, but turned the flat pebble again and again, hoping to uncover the suggestion of a head. Damn, the new king anyway, his hated name. In disgust, he sailed the thin stone, watched it arc into wet wind over rocked walls and firs. Ahead of him, the tang of the near sea, as he walked out of his brogans, bare heels red to weather, but hobnails kept shining from the traveling. He walked away, ankles worn raw from turf and limestone dust from the town, imagined a spot along a track called Bowen's. He trudged on, sea sting in his nostrils, dreaming of a taste of a pinch of salt on a boiled patty, like the one he stole from the lazy bed too near the road, carried hidden like a plague plump beneath his coat. Years hence, on the other side, they asked him where he was from. Ireland, he mumbled in his chin. Where in Ireland? Begone was Ballygowan, the last name he remembered before he shipped, or else it wasn't. And I was talking to someone, I can't remember tonight, earlier about the change in the climate and the change, not just the economic climate in Ireland, but the things that's happening to the land. And one of these things is the Sitka spruce. which comes exactly from where I'm from Oregon. And it's sort of taken over the world here, and having traveled in this country for going on now 50 years, I noticed how much it's changed the way you see the land. You know, I spent this time facilitating the neural passageways to find my way around the country and knowing the country, and now with this new carpeting of green, it looks totally different. It's changed. This is kind of what this poem is about. It's called Tutnam's Trees, and he was one of the first, he and his brother, I think one of the first people to introduce the Sitka spruce, the plantation, to Ireland. So it's called Tutnam's Trees. By the small pool stands an oak sapling planted by God knows who. Ireland was once covered with oak forests and beech, sycamore, before the English came, the English oak for flotillas, for antique furniture. Now the marshes are green, another invader, Sitka spruce. We can't keep up with the evergreens blanketing the hills, the bogs, but no matter who planted them, they'll come down as fence posts, pulp and timber, where trees once stood, black bog again. It's Cotton waving. A little more history here. It's a little history and a little bit, who knows. I have a friend who lives up in Mayo, and he says, hey, Carlos, he says, don't ever let the facts spoil a good story. So I'm taking him as his word. And Packy Russell, if you don't know it, the Russell brothers were these famous folk musicians up in a place called Doon in West Clare. And one of them, Packy, was, in addition to being a stonemason, was a great storyteller. According to Packy Russell, Joe Dowling, Casement's emissary in 1916, is mistakenly dropped on Crab Island, the submarine commander thinking it the mainland. As the U-boat disappears in midnight fog, Joe realizes he's 500 yards offshore. But swim he must, the dark waters. Packy watches the dually key to take his hand and pull him from the water. I've heard these stories time and time again, when Packy's put aside the concertina, took a right healthy pull from his pint of the dark stuff, and began to yarn. Some night, it's Casement himself who stands, though book history says Sir Roger never came ashore, but south of the Shannon, on Bonnet Beach and Charlie Bay. Whatever was in it, you could see sure. Whatever was in it, you can be sure Packy is there, giving his hero the old IRA salute. I sat listening to Packy, fueling his enthusiasm with pints of Guinness. But alas, too often, before he was halfway through, the tape rewound. The German sub is again surfacing the lee side of Crab Island, ready to drop off the IRA emissary. Eager for some forgotten detail, my ears attended every telling and retelling of his tales of intrigue, though often he never finished. I was plenty willing to supply the liquid inspiration for Packy, Shanika of Fisher Street, to keep him talking, his tales more interesting than his concertina playing. Just before Gussie O'Connor rang the bell for last call, sang out, now gents, time. Joe Dowling, black beret pulled down over his right eye, forehead sweating, sneaks into the side door by the shop counter, not bothering to stop to pick up a six pack for after hours, his cat eyes searching for his biographer and a few pints or two for his story. But it's Rory, face as red as a lantern, who's cruising the long bar, sidles up to a table, offering a whisper, just the possibility, a bottle of the best poutine along the coast. I think something like this happened down at Cork several years ago. At a cemetery, somebody saw the Virgin Mary wiggle her ear or something. Well, and not to disparage, but up around Clare.
That, yeah. That's better.
Yes. There's a, for all of it, looks like a phone kiosk, okay? But there's Bridget in this thing, this plastic, plexiglass thing that looks like a kiosk. And around the countryside, we begin to call her Bridget with the phone booth. But anyway, a Clare story. Our Lady of the Telephone Booth, Bridget by the roadside, out of Lahinch, up the incline toward the cliffs, just before O'Brien's monument and the pub. The parade of cars coming up the hill, endless, all the way up the coast from Milltown. Don't you see, as I drove up the grade, half awake and missing my tea, she turned and blinked from the glass enclosure. Had I blinked, I would have missed it. I couldn't believe what I'd seen. It rattled me. A drink was what I needed. I pulled into the near pub. Had to tell the publican, who gave me a look and went straight to the phone. Maybe that's a Cork story too. But someone else, we were talking today about the lack or the amount or lack of wildlife in Ireland, especially in these latter days. This is called Life and a Pine Marten. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong thing. That's okay. A pine marten is still here and around the places, you probably know that. Life in a Pine Marten. One. In 1790, the Harrens raised the 3-foot thick rock walls, attached the roof of the little cottage on the bog beneath Kirkodee. A quiet place, the neighbors said, and left the rest to us when we bought it and moved in 1972. We soon had it done up, washed white with blue barge boards, a bright red door clearly visible from the county road, and red smoke from the chimney, our calling card telling the folks around Letterkelly and Cloonaha the Yankee man was back. It was rustic, floor, Liscannor flags, hearth, the only heat. Kindly neighbors gave us plenty of peat to burn. As I piled sods of turf on the fire, we built the life in this cottage. Two. But when snow fell, when snowflakes fell between us and on Mount Callan, it was mighty cold, hard to get the fire going, easy to let it die out, leave but ashes on the hearth. Three. The last time I slept in a cottage, a pine marten in the attic kept me awake chewing sheets of styrofoam we put up in the rafters for insulation, making himself a future home. I got out of bed, took a broom handle to the ceiling boards. My thumping scared him away, but the pine marten moved in to stay. Now there's a forest growing up around the place. The woman who built the life with me there no longer returned. With Ireland, it wasn't so much a divorce as a separation. I lost heart, didn't come home for a time. When I did, it was just me and the pine marten. I couldn't put up with the racket. I left him with the, I left the cottage to him, and I was left with the guilt of leaving. Now, I'd like to read a couple of poems that have absolutely, I was going to say absolutely nothing to do with Ireland, but that's not, it's not true, because it seems like wherever in the world I travel, Ireland sort of creeps in. for my work. And I see Ireland in that place, and you say to yourself, well, I think India would be the strangest place in the world you'd see Ireland. In Bangalore. I spy a woolly wagtail beside the pool of the food court. Think of Ireland. But home is always where I am at the moment. Remembering the terrace where I had breakfast this morning, the cabana's thatched roof could only have been accomplished by an artful Irish thatcher. And beside the cabana, the bamboo could only be Panama, Central America. And you all know about the for the Indians, the cow being sacred. And you might think the traffic is fierce in Cork or in Dublin, but you haven't seen traffic till you see some of the places in India. But there's a curious thing, and many of you might know this, but you couldn't get across four lanes of rush hour traffic in a tank. But one single cow can start across those four lanes and everything stops. Cow herds on the inter-ring road. The two fragile, ageless, venerable women in braids and bright saris, armed only with willow switches, drive a herd of 12 cows down the inter-ring road. They lead the rush hour parade, bumper to bumper, crawling cars, buses, giant Tata lorries, and auto rickshaws. Patient in the way Indian drivers are not. No horns honking, they know that if they hit one of those cows, their karma is ruined forever. Not even the usual gutsy, dodgy, Kannada-speaking rickshaw drivers will chance getting past the animals. The drover in the back of their herd knows exactly what constitutes sin against the sacred cow, knows just how hard she is allowed to swat the lagging beasts. One cow spots a green weed in the rubble of a vacant lot, bolts from the herd, lunges up onto the sidewalk, and through the gap in the wall. Irish cowboy that I am, I should make an attempt at rounding up the stray bovine. As I make for the cow behind the wall, I bump into a young lad buttoning up. He looks embarrassed and puzzled. I'm hoping he'll help me corral the beast, coax it back onto the road. He shrugs and goes on out of the gap, back to the sidewalk, leaving me. I don't have the Hindu words for calling a cow. I certainly won't swear at it. The cow decides it for me. She has what she came for, and thoughtfully, still chewing her cud, lumbers out to rejoin the herd. Right. And I'll make them short. It's called thread count. It is a place where cotton is still picked by hand, and it's a murderous kind of job. It kills your cuticles. The cotton molars are very sharp parts of the curve. Thread count. How many threads per inch in the white sheet she's going to sleep on? The woman ahead of me at the wedding bedding shop wants to know. The clerk won't be able to answer her when I ask her how many brown fingers have those threads gone through before arriving here. How many lives do these threads reach back to? What happened to the drops of blood from cuticles torn by cotton bowls in the fields of India, Egypt? A final very short poem. I gave a reading in Bangalore, and when I was talking to the Secretary for Cultural Affairs, I think it was, about the reading, the name Yeats came up, and some of you will know that Yeats was a fan of Tagore and also a translator of that poem. For Tagore, for India. Today, which untouchable bends from the waist holding her sari in one hand, comes with her whisk to sweep the dark corners of your sleeping heart. Thank you.